Okay. All right. We'll call the meeting of the HDC Audit Committee to order, and I note the presence of the quorum. So the first item in the agenda is to approve the minutes of the members' meeting held on January 27, 2020. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second? Shall I second it?
Yes.
Mayor Sinney.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's gonna just, it might keep popping in and out. It
Okay.
isn't, but so I'll try to stay. Keep going. I'm sorry.
Okay, we have a second?
Yes.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, Rich, you want to go through the agenda items?
Sure. Because of obviously, well, it's great to be meeting together, even if it's virtually. Eric and I will provide you with a COVID-19 update on how things are going, you know, as far as the staff and our performance and the like, and we'll give you some insight into that. Then we will have the second quarter report by then Ellen will do the debt and investment reports. Mary will do credit risk. She has a few internal audit reports as well as the audit committee charter, which we'll need a vote at the end.
Okay. So Eric, the COVID-19 update, please.
Yeah, happy to do that. It's great to see everyone. And as you know, I've tried to kind of send out a periodic update. We have sent out a lot of updates and had obviously a ton of meetings with staff. I've tried to reach out to the board at least periodically to let folks know what's been happening. And we've had some phone calls in that direction as well. It was a hasty exit, as it was for many people. We had started to make some preparations even in late February, early March. I think a lot of folks could see where this gathering storm was going, even in February. And so at the beginning of March, we put into place a number of things to get kind of training up on this kind of telecommuting and making sure that people could stay in communications, making sure that everyone on staff had the proper materials and technology to work from home. And then we put in place some training and some testing very early March to make sure people could try at least to work from home for a couple of days to see where the problems were. And our team performed really tremendously well across the board. The IT folks have been remarkable, but we have found that all, literally, maybe there's a small percentage of work that is directly related to office operations and maintenance operations that cannot be done remotely, but effectively all of our work functions have been able to continue online. And a lot of that, or at least part of it, has been with the assistance of changes that have come out of the state and city government recently with the county. So there's been a lot of kind of forbearance on efforts to be able to do things online that we previously might not have been able to do before, and things have been streamlined and simplified. So all of our business activities are continuing very, very well. Our staff is doing well. While we don't, you know, report out on individual conditions, that we don't have a lot of staff concerns at this point. We're obviously concerned about people's well-being and mental health issues. So we've got those kinds of concerns that are going on. And then we've also turned our attention to, once we got through kind of just business continuity, can everyone hear for a second? I just want to check.
Yes.
Okay, because there's a lot of you guys, I don't know if you guys have it, but I got a lot of visuals popping on and off and a lot of kind of timing things. So I don't know if you guys see that same spinning that I do. So once we got the business continuity stuff kind of nailed down, we turned our attention to, we're doing a lot of education and advocacy. We've been participating in a lot of the work around what the CARES bill needed to be, now what the HEROES work needs to be, what kind of programs are important, what kind of things we need to do on a forward-looking basis. And some folks, Denise included, knows the kind of work that we've been doing in some of the groups that we've been talking to and organizing with, and through trade associations, doing that kind of organizing and advocacy and communication. And I think a good portion of it has been fairly effective. There are some things that we obviously have concerns about, mainly additional aid to states and cities. That is included in HEROES, but obviously doesn't look like it has much traction yet. We've also been concerned that there was a lot of immediate attention paid on the single family side with some really strong forbearance programs, particularly through the GSEs and FHFA, the ability to kind of forbear to owners and put debt at the back of their loans. The same equivalent has not been extended yet to single family. There's some forbearance through the GSEs as well on that side, but it's much more limited, and we think it has to be stronger. We've also advocated for a set of policies that would address the tenants directly, and some of that has happened. And a lot of the way the federal government views it and other advocates on that side say is that there's a lot of income support right now, whether it's the $1,200 one-shots or whether it is the payroll protection plan that's come forward or whether it's the enhanced unemployment insurance that's come forward. The argument is that on the multifamily side, a lot of that income support should make its way through to the collection side. And Rich will talk about asset management in a minute. We don't find that to be entirely true, although not everyone in New York State. We know from the state folks that 2 million people, we believe, are have applied and qualify, and we think benefits are flowing on about 1.5 million. There are more people who are eligible who have not even applied yet, so there should be more cash flow coming on the unemployment insurance side, but not entirely there yet. But in this kind of suite of activities, we focus on tenants that we just talked about. Then next, we talk about building and building kind of stabilization, and there have been some programs and ideas put forward to that end, mainly around enhancing Section 8 contracts in some cases, or what's described as kind of a revolving refundable credit to building operators. If you lose rent, you could get a piece of it replaced, sort of the way that the kind of $1,200 reverse flow went to individuals. You could actually have a reverse flow to some buildings in that way and then kind of true up at the end of the year. We'll see how much traction that gets. And then the last piece of it is to make sure that the financial system remains solid and solvent around multifamily financing. And to that end, there's been a proposal for a facility, a liquidity facility that would be Treasury and Federal Reserve that would actually, through servicers, make payments. And with both building assistance and financing assistance would come a requirement for forbearance to tenants as well. So it's across that whole suite of tenant building and finance structure. At the end of the day, a lot of it works to make sure that tenants can remain in place and are supported while the system remains solvent, that buildings can continue to operate and maintain themselves, and that the financing system can remain whole. And then the last piece that I'll touch on is that we're looking forward at this point. You know, there's a lot, we won't go into too much detail on it, but there's a lot of discussion of the restart, which looks in New York City, the first pieces of it. We're hearing from both the state and city folks that June looks like a possibility for some pieces of it in this phase one to begin. A lot of that looks like pieces of safe construction that can happen and manufacturing that could happen. And then the phases that would follow that, based on, you know, how we look on these kind of indexed numbers, there's 7 indicators that the state looks at and at least 3 that the city's looking at, would determine what regions and parts of the state could open. And so that would be a data-driven thing. Generally, there's a significant period of time between the first phase and the next phase to ensure that the numbers aren't being driven up in a dangerous way. So just on a speculation basis, we don't really see an office opening until probably late summer and potentially later. That said, we've been very able to do our work in place. And I want to, unless folks have questions, immediately turn it over to Rich and kind of talk a little bit about what I alluded to on kind of the asset management, rent collection, and debt collection.
Sure. Well, as Eric mentioned, we are functioning very well remotely. And I'd like to thank Paul and our IT team for ensuring that the staff have the needed tools to be effective from home. Our systems permitted working from home, and we have enhanced them with both hardware and software to make that more efficient. And that process continues remotely. We've shifted to the cloud. That has made things a bit easier. We've maintained our cyber defenses and are continuing to improve them. And we will report about them in more detail in the future. Staff have been super responsive and adaptive to the new environment. We've all become avid users of Teams and Zoom and now WebEx. Our engineers are doing virtual inspections of projects. with the borrower's team walking them through the buildings with their phones or tablets to transmit to the HDC staff. Our marketing review and compliance staff review files remotely, and the pace of leasing and our file review continues apace with developments concurrently being rented. The corporation is entering the bond market next week and has an offering document publicly available. The capital markets municipal bonds have strengthened after a volatile period right after the realization of the spread of COVID. Interest rates are low, and that will facilitate our lending programs. Unfortunately, investment rates are greatly lower, and this reduction will have a significant negative impact on the corporation's income. Staff expects to see a significant reduction in income from lower issuance as well as lower investment returns during the second half of the fiscal year. But Mary John will report shortly about our successful first half of the year. Our accountants are working well remotely and finished the second quarter unaudited financials earlier than usual in order to facilitate your review today. The corporation's finances are generally strong, as you know, and staff have consistently recommended additions to HDC's reserves that the members have approved as HDC grew in order to prepare for potential downturns. As the corporation faces significant challenges, staff and I advise you that HDC is well positioned to address these in the near term. To satisfy rating agency requirements, staff tests cash flows under extreme stress, and HDC can cover such losses if necessary. Regarding the loan portfolios, the corporation's asset management staff are working with our borrowers to provide debt relief where necessary and releases of reserves if requested. Currently, most borrowers are reporting reductions in rent collections, but are generally covering costs. HDC will likely see a few forbearance requests this month, and that may accelerate. The situation continues to evolve, and if unemployment remains high and benefits are not extended, there may be bigger problems as residents may be unable to pay rent in the future. HDC will need to work with the city and housing advocates, as Eric mentioned, to ensure that the resources needed to address those challenges, as well as a mounting a vigorous recovery from the pandemic and the economic downturn, are provided by the federal government. Are there any questions?
We're assuming that the May rent roll analysis is going to look not good. Well, April wasn't too bad. Are you making that same assumption? You're basing what you just said on looking forward, or based on?
So Denise, we're in contact with a bunch of our borrowers, and I think that you're right that there is a concern. April went pretty smoothly. May is rockier. We did do an analysis. Remember, the portfolio is sort of pretty varied. There's a fair amount of Section 8. There's a lot of LIHTC, which has relatively large reserves. There are the older PLPs and that are probably tighter transactions that don't have big reserves. So it really depends on which ones we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And Eric touched on this earlier, you know, it depends a little bit on when relief funds flow through and if they do, and then the nervousness that people have about their future. And then there's a little bit about the population that are housed in our developments, and it's surprisingly uneven, that you'll see, like, it could be in a small development, you know, that has 40 units, and if 10 people are having a problem, that's, you know, or you could have 20 people having a problem, while in a building of 300, you might have only 20 as well. It just depends. It's very variable. But we're very much engaged with our borrowers about that.
And then just one last point. You mentioned you're going out to the bond market. So you guys won't need the muni facility, or is that some other part of the city that might rely on that?
Yeah, you know, we don't need the muni facility. What is helpful about the muni facility is that it creates liquidity in the market, and that improves the overall marketplace. And what we're finding is housing is because, unlike, you know, 2009-10, when housing was perceived as the problem, even though affordable housing wasn't, that that's not the case. We're actually perceived as, at a time when everyone's challenged, there's no more important place than their homes, and people want to figure out how to stay there and the like. And I think that has changed the dynamic and the strength of the portfolio, and the fact that we historically do a lot of stressing and that we maintain reserves in order to address those stresses has made us into actually a pretty strong credit in comparison to ones that are more subject to tax revenue or fee income, you know, in particular like the transit or university dormitories, senior housing. Those have been really much more worse impacted than our normal product.
Thanks.
Hey, it's Kyle. I had two. One's an asset manager question, and one's so one first asset manager question is: is the HTC and so Con Edison, NYSERDA, and the city are doing an air conditioner program this summer for vulnerable folks, and there's a whole process set up. It looks like the Section 8 and NYCHA folks are being handled by the city directly. So we're doing a voucher program. HTC involved in any of that? Do you know?
I don't think we have been, but we will follow up with City Hall to sort of see if we can be of assistance in that. So, I mean, both with HPD and with City Hall to do that. Because I don't think that we've been brought in yet.
Yeah, you may not necessarily need to be, but.
No, we've definitely heard about this. We are in regular contact in the evenings with City Hall. There's a readout to all the commissioners and a check-in. We're aware of that program existing, but to Rich's point, HTC has not been directly contacted. It feels like it's going to run through other channels, but if we need to be, okay. We certainly would engage.
Got it. And the second question is, just speaking of NYCHA, is that sort of, are we full steam ahead in our relationship with NYCHA and that program?
We are. I mean, what I would say about that, we're still working to close this Manhattan bundle that's next. You know, obviously, you know, when I said we're looking ahead, there's a lot of questions around, and we're all working to kind of formulate the best approach around new construction versus preservation. And then there's kind of a hybrid thought about what you define as infrastructure. And there are a lot of times when a lot of the more significant systems work at NYCHA, and just the structure of NYCHA itself can be thought of in many ways, or at least advocated as infrastructure. So the question becomes, what can you do safely right now? And so there's not much in place, tenant in place rehab work happening, and a lot of NYCHA preservation work is that at a minimum. And then conversely and ironically, you know, it seems like it's a lot easier and safer to build new construction, yet at the same time, we really don't know where rents and vacancy are going to be on the other side of this exactly. We also don't know, you know, what time frame for construction is necessarily going to be. We're working through those questions, like how long is a new construction project going to take with safe protocols in place? What are the additional expenses in construction? We just had a conversation this morning with Terry and Rich and others about that. So we're gathering information about that to try and make sure. And then we're putting together, this also is under the category of looking forward that I mentioned earlier, we're putting together a small set of transactions, as is the state, that we think we can close this summer, and that makes sense to do. So we're working on that as well. I hope that gets to your question.
Rich, the forthcoming bond issue is a general obligation or is it for specific?
So it's a revenue bond. It's in the open resolution. These are bonds that the members approved at the late November meeting. And this, you might remember that a bunch of projects were forward committed where we didn't have enough volume cap in 2019 to finance the full project. And so we committed volume cap to be done when it was available in 2020. And so we are now doing those transactions. So these are all previously approved transactions. And there's also a portion that's a securitization that you also approved where we try to raise capital to support the overall programs, as well as a securitization of one of the loans that we made to the NYCHA Brooklyn transaction. So there, and then there's a little bit of refunding too. So it's a hodgepodge, but it's all previously approved by the members. And what Eric was describing is there'll be a separate meeting this summer to approve the further transactions. So it's the open resolution, it's several series within it, and it's totaling a little under $300 million.
Thanks. Yeah, November seems like a decade ago.
Exactly.
Okay. The second quarter financial report, Mary.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm pleased to present the corporation's unaudited financial statements for the second quarter of fiscal year 2020, covering the period November 1, 2019 to April 30th, 2020. Corporation ended the second quarter with considerable uncertainty as the country faces a historic economic crisis from the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Nonetheless, I'm pleased to report that the second quarter financials were not materially impacted by the current economic conditions. The corporation's net position totaled $3.2 billion, representing an increase of $139 million, or 4.4% from fiscal year end 2019, generated from normal operating activities. Operating revenues were $303.5 million, an increase of $34.7 million, resulting from higher interest income on loans, as the mortgage portfolio increased by $1.4 billion from fiscal year end 2019. Non-operating revenues, which are primarily investment earnings, were $57.6 million, a decrease of $12.2 million, mainly due to the lower fair market valuation compared to the same period a year ago. Operating expenses were $222.1 million, an increase of $6.8 million or 3.2%. Bond interest, together with bond issuance costs, constitutes 90% of the corporation's total operating expenses. As of the end of the second quarter, HGC had raised $908 million in bonds and other debt obligations. Mortgage commitments on closed loans, including $124.6 million in subsidies, were in excess of $1 billion. Total assets were $22.7 billion, an increase of $1.3 billion or 6% from fiscal year end 2019. The increase was mainly due to the corporation's mortgage financing activities. Total liabilities were at $19.6 billion, an increase of $1.2 billion or 6.8% from fiscal year end 2019. The increase was due to a combination of bond financing, increase in mortgages funds held in escrow, and the fair market valuation on the interest rate swap portfolio. This concludes my remarks. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions?
No.
Okay. Then we'll go to the debt report, Ellen.
Okay, thank you. So the corporation's debt report is as of April 30th, 2020. The last debt report presented to the audit committee was as of December 31st, 2019. And during this time, the corporation issued three series and remarketed one series of open resolution bonds totaling $145.2 million and two series of bonds in the housing impact bond resolution, which is an ITA resolution, in the amount of $375 million. There are bond redemptions in seven series of open resolution bonds in the amount of $254.2 million and two standalone bond series in the amount of $10.7 million. The corporation's debt outstanding as of April 30th, 2020 is approximately $12.6 billion, and the corporation's statutory debt capacity stands at $14.5 billion. Questions?
Okay, there being none. Then we'll go to the investment report, Ellen again.
Okay. So the corporation's investment report is as of May 4th, 2020. The funds under management totaled approximately $5.6 billion, and this report reflects routine investment activity. Questions?
Okay. Any questions? Moving right along. Then we'll go to... The report on HGC credit risk exposure, Mary H.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The report before you is dated April 30th, 2020, and the last report presented to the audit committee was dated December 31st, 2019. There were no new additions to the approved list of counterparties, and there were two rating agency actions of note since the last report. In February, Moody's assigned an A2 P1 rating to Signature Bank. Signature Bank was previously not rated. And earlier this month, S&P downgraded HSBC Bank USA to A+, A1 from AA+, A1+, based on concerns regarding the holding company's restructuring plan, which they announced in February, as well as weaker earnings expectations. S&P maintains a stable outlook at this new rating level for HSBC Bank. HDC's counterparty exposure remains diversified, with the largest exposures continuing to be with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Investments rated AA or higher were 49% of total investments versus 48% at the last report, while investments rated BBB or not rated were 32% of total investments versus 50% at the last report. And please note that the BBB and not rated investments are fully collateralized by high quality U.S. Treasury or agency securities and or Federal Home Loan Bank letters of credit. The reduction in the BBB and not rated exposure was primarily due to the aforementioned rating assignment to Signature Bank by Moody's in February. And finally, HDC's exposure to liquidity providers remains unchanged since the last report. Any questions?
Okay, there being none, then Mary, please continue with the internal audit report.
Sure. There are four completed audit reports before you, as well as an internal assessment of the internal audit function for the calendar year 2019. So I'll start with the audit reports. Three of them are the required annual audits, and one is an audit of the corporation's bond issuance process. First up is the President's Office expenses. The objectives there were to determine the accuracy of the President's Office expenses recorded in Oracle and to ensure they were accurately reflected in the general ledger, and to determine whether the expenses classified under the President's Office adhere to the applicable policies and procedures for employee expense reimbursements. Upon completion of the audit, we noted no matters involving internal controls that we considered material weaknesses. We identified a few enhancements to process controls, but generally found that the corporation's guidelines were effective and adhered to. And as you can see from that report, roughly 75% of the President's Office expenses were related to training and conferences and legislative travel. And listed are the various controls which we examined. Are there any questions on this audit? If not, I'll move into the employee expenses audit. Our objectives there were to evaluate the effectiveness of internal controls over employee expense reimbursements and other related expenses to ensure they were appropriate, properly authorized, and accurately recorded, and to evaluate and test compliance with the corporation's policies and procedures related to employee and other related expenses. Upon completion of the audit, we determined that management has effective controls in place to ensure employee reimbursement and vendor payments were properly authorized, appropriate, and accurately recorded. We noted no matters of concern with respect to internal controls. And taking a look at the report, you'll see the various internal controls that we examined. And the top three expense categories were employee development, training and conferences, and membership dues. Any questions on that audit?
I assume that because of the remote working that this category may go up or did you just pay for whatever it was that staff needed in order to work remotely?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that generally the tech budget covers things like the working remotely. And so that's, we don't usually have to reimburse people. So even like for instance, I needed a laptop. So it was ordered by the corporation and then it got delivered to me and then I worked with IT to set it up. Okay. And so it's been like that. And so some of the tax expense budget may change. Interestingly enough, we often lag a bit. And so, I mean, I don't know, Cassie, if you want to add anything about that particular budget.
Well, the tech budget's usually about $2 million. And since we've really been set up to work from home, most staff had laptops anyway. So I think our COVID-19 tech budget outlay is maybe $50,000 or $60,000. So that was really good. And as Rich said, some of the IT projects that we had budgeted for, some of them may change a little bit, but a lot of it was based on cloud migration, which Paul and his team have been fully engaged in even remotely. So that's coming along. So it may change a little, but not much, but we're on target with that. But we will be saving money clearly on training and conferences because no one's going anywhere. But that's a small part of the budget anyway. That's only about $150,000. So.
For sure, my travel budget is like zero.
But as we said earlier, when we kind of started to do a very quick inventory, even in February, of who had what and who needed what, we were pleasantly surprised that probably 75% plus of the staff was pretty well set up to work from home. And so we really just had to move on the rest of it. Now, some of that, you know, a lot of folks are using their own equipment just because they had it or whatever, but you can do a lot of this stuff on a MacBook kind of thing. And that might, you know, over time raise some questions about, you know, you read more and more about companies that are talking about outfitting people at home more so, even on the space question. So I think it's a good long-term question, Denise, that we should probably keep an eye on, because I imagine, you know, it's not like we want everyone an office set up, and most of us probably can't print and do things like that here, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, we'll tackle in the same problem, so
And so we have folks...
Go ahead, Rich.
I was just going to say, we have folks who use their own computers who then enter our systems through either a VPN or through Citrix. There are other people who are on office supplied, you know, HTC supplied laptops. And so we have a variety of different, and it's generally working, and where we've had additional experience, and we may have some more. We really took a very clear attitude that we wanted to facilitate people's ability to function from home. And when we can say with a straight face that essentially everyone is functioning from home, it's because of that expenditure. And so it's been well worth it. Is it ideal? We all know everyone's dealing with this, right? That it has its challenges, but we would say that our functionality has been really great, and our IT department has totally delivered for us in so many ways, and we really do appreciate that.
Just a question: you touched on this. Are you making active plans for reentry in December, or are you sort of planning on, like, what kind of plans are you making for the fall?
Jim Quinlan, who's been working a lot with City Hall on it, who might want to add some comments. I can say what we're doing right now is it's very, very preliminary. So we've had this kind of back and forth where we're drafting plans, and a lot of it's been conceptual with kind of thought experiments of, like, you know, folks saying, think about what you would need, think about what it would mean, think about how your work would need to change or could change, what kind of scheduling could happen. We are very fortunate in that we are much more able to work remotely, as I think a lot of organizations like ours are. So it wasn't as difficult to transition out, and we imagine it can be a fairly flexible transition back. The main difference would be that on the way out, it was very abrupt and as best organized as we could. On the way back, we intend to do it in a very orderly way to kind of manage people's concerns and issues. So luckily we can work. And so we'll see. So it's been a bit of both. It's a little bit of like a thought experiment. It's a little bit of following the numbers, but there is a bit of a drumbeat. And we've started that internally as well to kind of get people thinking about that, because at some point you do have to get back to some level of life when the numbers are safe enough to do that.
But I think, Eric, whether you're a corporation or organization, there are going to be a lot of those entities saying, you know, it worked pretty well. Do I keep, for the most part, maybe they come in one day a week or whatever, the employees at home because it worked, and versus $80 or $90 a square foot for commercial office space? It may be a fairly easy decision for a lot of companies going forward.
It could have a real impact on commercial real estate.
Yeah.
It's true.
Eric, we did a survey. If it's helpful, I can. So we did a survey in my department, and then it was sort of a corporate-wide survey about just what people's concerns are about reentry, and what they would need, like specific things they would need to feel more comfortable, like separate apart from of the things that we can control. So
yeah,
apart from subways and stuff like that. It's not groundbreaking or like super shocking, but it is, it does give you a sense of where the distribution is. I'm happy to share that with you just to guide your
We'd love to see it.
Of what people care about, and you know, it's separate things like it tests sensitivities to, you know, alternate schedules. You know, so some people are Monday, Wednesday, Friday people. Some people are Tuesday, Thursday people. Some people are every other week people. We tested out mandatory masks, a lot of different things, getting rid of kitchen supply, all that kind of stuff. And it gives you a sense of where people's sensitivities are that you may not necessarily totally think about.
Perhaps not anything like that. I'm sure we'll be collecting things and thinking about it. And obviously there's like, you know, geographic distribution, where people are coming in from and how they have to commute. There are things like who has kids at home and what happens with right. schools that we can't quite predict yet.
Yep.
People with may have pre-existing conditions that they're concerned about that may or may not have ever been disclosed. And there's all those issues. And then there's, you know, all kinds of, there's just all kinds of questions like that, even just, you know, what kind of age cutoffs are kind of appear to be at risk. And so there's going to be a lot of stuff to work through, I think, on this.
And just to the final point on this is, I think it was surprising that I think this is kind of confidential, but I'm happy to share with this. You know, a big portion of the population was not comfortable returning under any circumstances short of a vaccine, mm-hmm. Which is understandable, number one. But number two, that sort of is illuminating that there's a certain portion of your workforce, and yours may be higher, maybe lower, that just doesn't feel the need to come in. It's not that they want to quit their jobs. It's they feel like they can, it's unnecessary. So I think it's really illuminated that there is a certain portion of our workforces that just doesn't need to come in. So why force it?
Thank you.
You know, I know we're disrupting your schedule here, but cybersecurity, I'm curious. It's certainly, we've gotten more hits. Not that they've been successful, but attempts, let me put it that way. Is that happening on your end or not so much?
There's been a little, and Paul can provide a little more detail. You know, we also are sensitive in a public meeting to not go into too much, but basically there's been some phishing that has gone on. One was actually on the borrower side, where it was coming to them, and so someone had basically recaptured our billing and then tried to redirect it, and so that sort of stuff happened before. And is happening now, and I think we have heightened, you know, sensitivity to that. And we had already done a correction on our billing to say that if you get any communications that ask you to redirect a bill, please call blank blank and blank blank. Right. So that way there wouldn't be. I mean, that's the sort of thing that we do worry about. But Paul, I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
No, that was a great summary. I mean, that's exactly right. That these things we do see. These things continuing, and sometimes the scammers explicitly reference coronavirus or COVID-19 because they know that people are working from home. Their whole goal is to get you to deviate from protocol, right? Deviate from your normal procedure, and so we are on high alert for that.
And we have to have a fuller discussion in an executive session.
Okay.
Okay. Mary, the approval of the audit committee chair.
I have a couple of other audits I need to complete.
Oh, okay.
next up is the petty cash audit. Our objectives there were to determine whether adequate controls to ensure that the cash asset was safeguarded and maintained in the proper amount. Petty cash disbursements were in compliance with the corporation's policies and procedures, and the Empress Fund was properly authorized and reconciled. And on completion of that audit, we found that petty cash disbursements were in compliance with all policies and procedures, and we noted no matters involving internal controls. Any questions on that audit? If not, I'll move forward to the bond issuance process audit. Our objectives there were to ensure that there are adequate and effective bond issuance practices, proper oversight and governance, to determine the accuracy of bond proceeds and the initial transfers of debt issuance and closing, to ensure compliance with volume cap regulations and the use of such source as part of the bond issuance, and to analyze the cost of issuance and assess reasonableness. And upon completion, we determined that HDC has adequate controls and procedures in place over the bond issuance process and that there's proper oversight and governance. Specifically, board approvals were in place, bond amounts, ratings, and interest rates reconciled with the corresponding bonds official statements. All third parties were properly authorized and approved. Bond purchase agreements were signed by authorized principal officers and signed New York City comptroller certifications were on file. Volume cap allocation and listing of projects were properly declared and filed in IRS Form 8038. Bond proceeds were confirmed and recorded in the general ledger and deposited in the corresponding BPA bank account. And data analysis showed that the average cost of issuance for the five open resolution bonds issued during the scope period was within a reasonable range relative to similar bond issuers. And you'll see all of that information on the report there. Any questions? If not, my final internal audit report is the annual internal assessment of the internal audit function for calendar year 2019. This report is part of the corporation's quality assurance and improvement program, which mandates that the internal audit function performs periodic self-assessments. And the attached report highlights the structure and activities of the internal audit department, including all audits completed, relevant departmental changes, governance and oversight activities, and updates regarding employee development and ongoing training that helps to ensure that staff remains current on all internal audit best practices. Any questions? Okay.
There being none. Okay. No questions, then you want to go on to the next item?
Yes. I'm pleased to present to the members for their approval the Audit Committee Charter, which is attached in your packet today. The Corporation's Audit Committee Charter requires an annual review by the Audit Committee to determine the Charter's adequacy. The last time the Audit Committee approved revisions to the Charter was May 30th, 2019. There have been no changes since last year's revisions were approved by the members. An approval of the attached Audit Committee Charter is requested at this time.
So moved. All in favor? Okay. Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Any other business? Well, if there's no other business, I would like to call for a motion to adjourn. Second. All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Be well, everyone, and be safe.
Right. Take care, y'all.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Good weekend.
Bye. Thanks.
I guess.